what people are looking for now is a struggling photographer that needs to take that kind of assignment and be happy to do it for $2,500. And I'd rather someone that's struggling and needs $2,500 to run out there and try and do it. But I also know from a logistics point of view that it's not even possible to do it.
Welcome to the Pro Photographer Journey Podcast, your resource for building the photography business of your dreams. This is Shamira Young, bringing you tips, business strategies, and interviews with award-winning photographers. We're all in this together. Let's get to the good stuff. Hi, everybody. I'm here with nature and wildlife photographer Martin Bailey. Martin, say hello.
Hi there.
You know, I'm super excited about the discussion that we're going to have today. And I'm also really thankful because you are in Tokyo, Japan.
Yeah.
So what time is it where you're at?
Oh, it's 10 p.m. So it's not too bad.
Martin, my brain is shut down by about 7 p.m. So extra kudos to you.
Well, thanks for giving me a little bit earlier slot as well. It makes a big difference.
Not a problem. So today we're going to have an awesome discussion. And really, I can't wait to talk about your business model. That's one of the things that I really geek out about. And that's why I started the podcast. But first, can you give us an overview of yourself, your background, and how you ended up doing what you're doing today?
Sure. So I've got a slightly strange background, haven't we all? But I was born in England, as you can tell from the accent. But I left school in the middle of Thatcher's Britain. You know, there was millions of people out unemployed and there was riots and things. And so basically none of the people that I were at school with that I knew that went to uni. It was a pretty bad time for England. And so I sort of had a really, you know, talking about education and things, I didn't really have an education back in England. But when I was 24, I had the opportunity to move to Japan. Initially, it was just for short-term contracts. And of all things, I was making lace, you know, as in big wrought iron lace machines.
Literal lace?
Yeah, yeah. Oh. So the 100-year-old lace looms that I was... It's a skilled trade where I used to live in Nottingham in England. But I had the opportunity to come to Japan doing that. And I, at the time, I'd been hoping to use my brain a little bit more. It's a skilled trade. It takes a few years to learn. But once you've learned it, it's still a factory job. Mm-hmm. So I'd started to look into going to high school to learn German, and then I got a chance to come to Japan. And I thought, oh, great, Japan, that Japanese. If I learn the language, that's even cooler. So a week after I went for the interview, I jumped on a plane and came to Tokyo. Well, at the time, I came to northern Japan in Fukushima, where they've got the nuclear power plant problems now.
Yeah.
And I did that job for 4 years, and then when I was 28, I went to college here in Japan and then studied various things. I actually studied multimedia. So this started to put me on the track that I've followed through into photography, because I was being taught how to use Photoshop version 3, like in 1998.
Wow.
So it was, plus, you know, lots of other cool software. So I left college with a good computer background. I'd learned Japanese. But then I went back to England for 3 years until 2000. And then I started working for a Florida-based IT-related company. Did that for 10 years. But then during those 10 years, since 2005, photography had always been a passion. And so, you know, from my late teens, I'd be hiking in the hills in England, in Derbyshire, and with a camera photographing the scenes that I was seeing. As I was doing this job between 2000 and 2010, my photography became more than a passion. I started doing my own photography podcast in 2005, and that helped me to sort of start to build a business. I was taking commercial assignments as well, not a lot, but you know, enough to build my confidence in that part of photography as well. But then it all sort of worked out that by 2010, I had built enough of a photography business on the side that I thought it was time to just cut the cord. So I left my old company and I started doing photography full time. You know, which is it really from that point on, I started to, I knew by this time that I didn't want to be an assignment photographer, basically because the, you know, people no longer understand the value of a photographer. They, and I never wanted to be a poor, struggling photographer. Mm-hmm. So I, from the very start, it was always my plan to build the business around photography tours and stock sales and print sales and photography education. And so far, 6 years in, it's going pretty well.
So 2010, I'm thinking back. Well, I know 2010 in this country here in America, it was in the United States, it was rough. So yeah, 2008 is kind of when the bottom fell out of a lot of things. And everybody has a story here about being laid off. I was laid off in 2008. And so I know 2010, things were still kind of struggling. How was it in Japan then? You were still in Japan, right?
I was. So, I mean, it was tough. We were hit by a lot of the problems that the global economy suffered from. It turns out that the company that I used to work for, 2 years after I left, they closed the department that I was in down anyway.
Oh my goodness.
So, you know, I mean, I would have been without a job if I'd stayed with them. But for me, the time was right. I'd reached a pivotal point. And I actually, what I did was I backed myself into a corner on purpose by agreeing to work as a photographer, teaching people on an Antarctica voyage, an expedition to Antarctica, where wow. I was going to help people with their photography. And I was always, at the time, I was already running my own winter tours here in Japan. We've got some beautiful winter wildlife. And I was already running those tours. So I was using up all of my annual leave. And so that means that for me to do the Antarctica trip, I had to quit my job. So mm-hmm. I said, yes, I'll do it. I'd got about a year to plan and to ease myself out of the job. But it was really the time. And so, you know, it's gone pretty well, but it was one of those scary things because I was in a well-paid job. I had no guarantee that I was going to be able to start and build out my tours even more. I was already selling prints a few a month maybe, but there was no guarantee that I was going to really be able to build out my print sales and stock. At the time, there was nothing. All of the stock, the value of stock had dropped, and it's continued to drop. I remember reading Getty's TOC.
Terms of service.
So I was reading through that, and it looked like I was going to get like a few cents per image if I signed up. And I just thought, no way, I'm not selling my work for that price. But as it turned out, just as I started to do my, as I started to make photography my livelihood, my career, rather than a passion and a hobby, I was approached by Offset, Offset is a sister company of Shutterstock, and they were building a high-end stock library, where they were going to be charging $250 or $500 per image, rather than 250 cents per image, and less even. So you know, I got in Offset during their beta, so my images were in their library as they launched, and that's been invaluable. I mean, that literally pays my rent some months, and some months it pays my rent for a few months. So the stock sales and things like this, I hadn't planned that, but being out there and doing what I'm doing helped me to get noticed and invited into a company like Offset. So it's sort of snowballed around what I started to do, which was the tours. Because, you know, the thing is that while I'm on the tours, I shoot for myself as well. Mm-hmm. The customers come first. If there's a spot to be had, I put a customer there and I'll shoot over their head or something. But I also am able to photograph for myself while I'm traveling. So I come back from these locations with some great shots that I sell. I use to illustrate my own ebooks, which I sell. And so anyone that comes to my blog or sees my ebooks, reads one of my ebooks, they're introduced to my photography. And the next thing they're thinking, oh, you know, that's not too bad. That's not a bad photo. I wonder where he shot that. And then they're looking at my tours page. And the next thing you know, they're sitting on a bus with me in Iceland or something like that. So it's all sort of self-perpetuating. And it's like I say, it's opened up doors. And one of my best-selling images was from Antarctica. I was there. I was being paid to be there. But one of my images from Antarctica was sold for, with an exclusive license, and literally will pay my rent for a year probably about a year. So
Wow. It
really all does, it's all feeding back into itself, self-perpetuating.
So one thing that I love about this podcast, and I kind of mentioned this in our pre-interview chat, is that it's helped me become aware of the different business models out there. Because I think many people starting out, they're not sure how to start out or how to make money or what avenues that they can use to bring in income. And so for you, just to make sure that I understand everything, so you bring in income through tours, through educational resources for photographers, educating photographers, and through stock sales.
Yes.
Yeah. How interesting. Okay. And are you, go ahead.
Sorry, I was, and print sales. I don't sell a lot, but I sell enough to make it worth making sure that I've got prints available on my website and things like that.
So that's people on your website going on a specific page and paying a fee to download the print, or?
Well,
how
no,
does that work?
It's a physical object. So I print it here
and I
sign it and send it off. I call them original prints, and it's kind of, a stupid thing to say when it's digital, because original print is like, if you bought an original Ansel Adams print, it was printed by him and dodged and burned in the dark room. But the same thing is, I mean, the way it's explained is that it means that the artist is making the print. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the photographer that shot the negative or whatever is then doing the print. And that's what I do. And I put a lot of care into it. I've become, pretty decent fine art printer. And so when I do a print, people know that it's going to be high quality and it's going to last 100 years or so, rather than just something that you can go in and get for $5 in Walmart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking on your site and it says original fine art prints. I like that wording personally, because it does assign value to what they're getting from you, for sure.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of false in the digital age, because once I'd set it up, anyone could print it. But because of the color management that I do and the proofing and the care and attention that goes into it, it actually, I think I am adding value. So,
and you know, that's a great point. I'm really glad you mentioned this, because I think it's something a lot of photographers may not realize. It took me years to realize the value that I was bringing personally as a photographer, because as you said, anyone could go to Walmart, right? Or,
right.
You know, Walgreens or whatever, and get, you know, a super cheap print for under a dollar. And so one thing that I've been trying to stress to my clients, because I work with a lot of businesses, is that if I'm printing something for you, even families with portraits, you're getting a much better product that you can put on your wall, in the case of families, than if you were to go and do it yourself, because there are color management issues, right? And there are, you know, you and I know how to work with printers and how to select a great printer as opposed to, you know, the average person who kind of, you know, if you go get a printer at Walmart, you might have a green cast to it, or not saying Walmart specifically, you know, has green casts on their photos, but wherever, it's not going to turn out looking right. And then they put that up and then that represents your work. So,
right.
Yeah, we bring tremendous value and knowledge to the craft.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So here's a question for you, and I'm curious what your answer is going to be, because you sell prints and selling stock on offset. So you're up against all of these amazing images. How do you make your images stand out from the crowd?
You know, I think that in some way I don't, because I believe I'm a good photographer, but I know that I'm nowhere near the best in the world. So I don't necessarily think that I'm making work that is better than a lot of people out there. I try hard, and what I do is I like to at least have something in my work that will induce an emotional response in the viewer. I think that, you know, even if it's just a slight flurry of happiness, you know, if someone looks at my photo and it makes them feel happy, then that's nice. If I can make them feel sad, that's nice. One of the best compliments I've been paid for my work was not words, but in actions. And this happened the first time my wife saw one of my photographs printed really large. She cried. Oh. I was thinking at the time it was because we're close. We've been together for 25 years or so. We have a relationship that is special to us. And I thought that she was reading into that, and she probably was. But then the highest praise that I had was when I did exhibition here in Tokyo in 2010, kind of putting a stake in the ground at the end of my passionate hobbyist photographer life, mm-hmm. when I was going to start. And then from that point on was professional. There was this lady came into the gallery, and you know, she stood there in front of one of my photographs and started crying. And I thought, oh my God, you know, it was amazing for me to be able to touch someone at that level, mm-hmm. with a photograph. And so I think that the reason for that is because I get very intimate with my subjects. I photograph, for example, the red-crowned cranes, these huge, big birds that live in the snowy winterland of Hokkaido, the northern island of Japan. And, you know, people are always looking for the high action shot. The other thing that I photograph a lot is snow monkeys here. And people are there. They're trying to get the photograph of them jumping across the river and things like that. And I do that for fun. But the results are never my favorite photographs. The best photograph for me is when, for example, the crane has its head sort of crooked over just at the certain angle. I have one of these on the front of one of my ebooks. And it's almost human. It's graceful. It's beautiful. It's not necessarily high action, but I think that the closeness and the respect for my subject comes across in my photography. And I think that is that's what sometimes affects people in an emotional way. And probably what has helped me to become successful as a photographer.
It sounds like you're very purposeful with your images.
I am. I'm patient. I'm impatient with some things. If I order something from Amazon, it's got to be here the same day But in my photography, and this is why my wife doesn't join me on my trips, but I can stand in front of a field of cranes for 2 days.
Oh my goodness.
And you know, in freezing cold weather, and be perfectly happy to do that. And if I get, I mean, this one crane shot that I just mentioned probably took me 4 years to get something that I was really happy with. There's another one where they're two cranes dancing, and they've got their wings spread out, and it's a beautiful snowy scene. That took me, I think, 8 years of traveling to Hokkaido in the winter to get that shot.
Wow.
And so I don't mean like 8 full years. It was 2 weeks every 8 years.
Yeah.
Every year for 8 years, sorry. But it's one of those things that, if you want to get the exact moment, you need to put in the time and be patient and really wait for that split second when the subject opens their soul up to you.
So with nature and wildlife photography, it seems like there's some very specific demands that come along with it. One of which is being patient as you're trying mm-hmm. to get that right photo. And the other, I think, is also some of the gear that you use. So sure. Let's kind of briefly touch on what you're using. And I like to preface this by saying that I don't think, what type of camera or lens that you're using will make or break your photography business. A lot of it is, you know, the know-how and what you decide to use the photos for and how you put them out there to the public. But with that said, you do need some specific gear for nature and wildlife photography, right?
Absolutely. I think wildlife and sports photography, I don't do sports, but They both require, generally require long lenses.
Mm-hmm.
And the my long lens of choice is a 200 to 400 millimeter with a 1.4 times extender built in. And that costs the same as a small car. So, literally, I mean, we're talking a $12,000-$13,000 lens.
Awesome.
Yeah, and so you can't photograph some of the images that I make with that lens with a 24-70. It's just not possible.
Right.
But
yeah.
I totally agree in that the majority of the time the gear is irrelevant. It's the brain and the eyes and the creativity behind the gear that really makes the photograph.
So for those who are starting out, I'm sure some of our listeners are trying to break into nature and wildlife photography. Because whenever I have an episode focused on this, I usually get very specific comments on social media. So what would be your advice to those who are just starting out? Like, what is the basic gear? Let's say they're buying their first lens and their first camera body. Like, what's a good starting point for them?
A good starting point, if you really need to split it or get some very wide lenses. But the best cameras... it's sort of like a mid-range camera for wildlife is the Canon 7D Mark II. That's got I think it's 8 frames per second. So you get a relatively fast frame rate. And it's got a crop factor. It's a 1.6 crop factor. So a 100 millimeter lens would give you the same size image as a 160 millimeter lens on a full frame camera.
Mm-hmm.
That's great for wildlife, but for nature, for landscape, you generally want a full frame camera. So, I have a 7D. I used to have a 1DX. I used to have all sorts of really fast frame rate cameras.
Yeah.
But I'm now doing all of my work, including my fast paced wildlife, with 2 EOS 5DS R bodies. And they're slow. They're 5 frames per second at best. But I, having done this for so many years, I've found that it's helped me to even become even better at what I do, because when I'm trying to get an eagle swooping down, catching a fish out of the sea, I can no longer just put it into burst mode and as the eagle swoops down. I've got to release the shutter at the exact point in time when the talons are out. And so I make it work probably because of the experience. If someone's really just getting into wildlife photography, then the 7D Mark II is probably the best camera they can do with that at the moment. But the thing is that because as I mentioned, I do also sell prints. I want the megapixels. I know that the megapixel doesn't make the photograph, but if you want to print something really big, mm-hmm. then you need more megapixels. And there are ways to enlarge images, but the less you have to do that, the better quality the final print will be. And so 50 megapixels in these new Canon bodies is just, for me, too tempting. I'd rather get a slower frame rate and really work the subject with my experience rather than relying only on the fast frame rate.
So what's your favorite photography accessory other than your camera? Tell us why.
It's probably my Really Right Stuff tripod. They're a US company and they make the most solid tripods and they're beautifully engineered. The tripods and ball heads, you want to caress them when they arrive. They're beautiful engineering. Aside of my camera and lenses, the thing that I feel is most important and helps me to make my work as quality work as it is probably my Really Right Stuff tripod.
Awesome. And I'm looking on your site through your landscape prints and... to me, your style strikes me as bold and very vivid. So I'm curious about your workflow after you take the photo. Could you kind of briefly touch on what your processing workflow is like? And don't feel like you have to give away any of your trade secrets or anything, but just in general.
You know, I've given away every secret I ever had in my own podcast. I actually, totally unrelated to answering your question, but when I first started doing my podcast, I actually had hate mail from pros that were telling me to stop giving away all the
Are
secrets.
you
It's
kidding me?
really,
Wow.
really. So the I've for the last 10 years, I've been a Lightroom user. By the time anyone hears this, I will actually be, I'll have switched to Capture One. At the moment, I'm migrating my entire workflow over to Capture One, just because the image quality is better than Lightroom, in many ways. I'm just about finished, migrating over 250,000 photographs. So,
Oh my goodness.
yeah, I'm going to start talking about this in my own podcast next week, but this will be in the past for your listeners. But some of the landscape work that you looked at, and it does feel very vivid. What it's probably is the it's probably been put through a little bit of a dose of silver effects, color effects, sorry, silver effects for black and white, and color effects for the color images. And that just sort of gives, say, for example, with my Iceland work, it makes the green in the moss feel like Iceland green moss. Generally, you lose that in images, but when you're there, it really is strikingly green. And so I like to bring that back. Just a straight raw photograph, even with a little bit of saturation, doesn't really bring that across. So if it's a very vivid image, then it's probably color effects. But I never use that on my wildlife. My wildlife work is generally pretty much straight out of the camera.
Oh, very cool. Very cool.
Thank
Yeah,
you.
I'm looking. I need to. Okay, I'm getting sucked into your website here. I'm supposed to be conducting an interview and I'm browsing photos.
Brilliant.
Awesome. Well, there are many challenges that come with running a photography business for yourself, especially full time. I mean, part time is hard too, but full time as well. So, could you speak to what would be the most challenging aspect of running your photography business, and especially with your specific model for bringing in income.
You know, for me, the biggest challenge, and again, this is something that we all come up against, but it's really just finding the time to do everything that I want to do. My wife helps me with the business on a part-time basis, but basically, I wear all of the hats. So I have to time slice between marketing, accounting, printing, sales, tour and workshop leader, writer, educator, and many of these things are all have to be done, switched between on the same day sometimes. So I generally, well, I mean, I get up relatively late because I work, my office is on the third floor of my apartment. So for me, going to work is a flight of stairs. So I get up at about 8-ish in the morning, which is a luxury these days. But then I straight after breakfast, I start looking at my email. I come up to the office at 9:30 and I'm up here until 7, and then an hour for dinner after that. And I'm back on the laptop next to my wife on the sofa, but I'm back on the laptop doing email and other stuff until after midnight. And that's pretty much every day. I mean, we have time out to go out for dinner sometimes, and we'll maybe watch a movie at the weekends. But if I'm awake, I'm generally working. And I don't necessarily want to make being a workaholic sound cool or something that I think people should be doing, because my ultimate goal is to work a lot less and still make enough money to feed my family. But there's a lot of things that I need to do. I'm forever trying to figure out how to make time to bring the next product or the next bit of education or the next ebook to market. And so it's really, for me, the biggest challenge is finding time to figure out how to fit in everything that I want to do.
If you're looking for a way to speed up your workflow and quickly take your photos to the next level, check out the professional Lightroom presets we're offering on ProPhotographerJourney.com. With a single click, use these presets as a solid starting point when editing your photos, and then customize each Lightroom effect to your liking. Your friends, family, and clients will be amazed at your photos. These preset styles include soft and subtle, all the way to dramatic and edgy. Just head to prophotographerjourney.com and check it out. You mean you're not taking photos all day long and, you know, not having to worry about the business stuff?
You know, well, that the it is the business. All of that is the business. I mean, it's I actually shoot probably less now than I did when I was doing it as a hobby. Because you've got to keep the back office running. I maintain my own website, and every summer when it's ridiculously hot outside here, I tend to do a bit of an update on my website, and so I'll be the web admin. I'll be in a command console updating a server on the other side of the planet, and you know, so I've got all of these different hats that I need to wear. But I do still, if I am not on a tour, I mean, when I'm on tour, it's photography from the moment I wake up until the moment we go to sleep. And so they're the best times, because it's really just the camera becomes an extension of my arm and my eyes, and it all just feels so natural. But when I'm here in the office, literally sometimes the most I can do is to run to the store and buy a bunch of flowers and then set up some studio lights and just do flower photographs in my studio, or maybe have a couple of hours in the local park. But for me, a lot of the time that's enough. I can actually make photographs that make me very happy and even make money because I sell them, just in the local park. And so, you know, personal projects like that are a big part of what I do, but I really just don't have the time to do a lot of that because I'm trying to run the photography business rather than be the 100% photographer.
Exactly. Yeah, I was being a little bit facetious in my previous comment, because there are many things that are not so sexy that we have to do in order to keep the business going. And I know when I first started, when I first stepped into photography for myself, I was under the impression I'd be taking photos all day long and it was going to be rainbows and unicorns and just awesomeness. And it was a rude awakening when I realized that most of what I was doing to run the business was actually stuff to run the business and not necessarily taking photos. Yeah. So that's something I do like to stress on this podcast, kind of a reality check.
Absolutely.
And I always say, if you want to stay as a hobbyist photographer, that's fine. But if you are stepping into the business, you have to realize that there are other things that come into play, like marketing, accounting, as you mentioned, sales. Yeah. If you're an educator, creating educational content for people, it can be quite a bit. It can be a lot.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So then what have you found to be the most effective techniques for bringing in income for your business?
You know, for me, I've pretty much stopped. I mentioned earlier that I did some commercial work. But people no longer understand the value of a photographer's time, and photography itself, the end result, has become so devaluated that I've pretty much given up even marketing myself as a commercial photographer. And when I started this business, I knew that it was going to be based around the tours and around the other products that I can make based on the work that I either make on personal projects or on the tours. And so I've just been happy to step back and not try to be the assignment photographer. I'd much rather spend my time. Say, for example, a few weeks ago, I was offered an assignment. Someone wanted 12 locations photographed here in Tokyo. Tokyo's a city with 13 million inhabitants. And they wanted, I'll give you the price in a moment. So they wanted 12 locations shooting in 4 days. They wanted great light, which means very early in the morning or just in the evening, of course. And there's only 8 dawns and dusks in 4 days, but they wanted 12 locations shooting in that kind of light. they wanted model releases for everyone that's in the photograph. Or everyone that's recognizable in the photograph, and they were going to pay like $2,500. And four days, even for myself, $2,500 isn't going to pay my day rate.
Right.
But to actually pull off an assignment like that, I would have needed a crew of people running around asking for model releases. Mm-hmm. There's no way in Tokyo you're going to get photographs in any place that, you know, that has, they wanted people in the photographs, but they needed model releases for them all. So there's no way that it's possible for, with just one person. And they weren't paying enough for one person for even a day and a half. Basically, I just said, you know, thanks for your interest. But if that's the final offer on the rate, then you'll need to find someone else. And that's what they did. You know, I mean, I didn't try to haggle for more money because people don't understand it. What people are looking for now is a struggling photographer that needs to take that kind of assignment and be happy to do it for $2,500. And I'd rather someone that's struggling and needs $2,500 to run out there and try and do it. But I also know from a logistics point of view that it's not even possible to do it. So, you know, they literally would need a crew of at least three or four other people to run around and actually get a model release from each of those people. And I honestly, with Tokyo, everyone's going somewhere. Everyone needs to be there yesterday. Mm-hmm. People aren't even going to stop to sign the model release for you. So, you know, it's just, and that's the sort of assignment that we're being offered now. I don't have the time to even talk about even try to negotiate for a reasonable price. And so that is something that I've really just walked away from. Now, if I do a few assignments a year, it's usually people that already know me, know that I'm gonna do them a really good job, and know roughly what I'm gonna ask them to pay me. And you know, they're the times that I'll do it. And if it's anything other than that, I really just don't bother, because I can make more money by sitting at home and writing a few chapters for my next ebook, or even just putting time in to do a really good quality podcast for the next week, because that all feeds back. I don't charge for the podcast at all, but everyone that listens to it hears my name. They know, you know, that I'm doing tours and things like that, and it all just sort of helps. I obviously don't think that everyone that listens to my podcast is going to end up on a tour with me, and that's in no way a requirement. But there's a possibility that a small percentage will. And so just being out there doing it, I would rather put my time in and just do a quality podcast and get that out there and you know, try to pass on the knowledge that I have on photography and the business and the creativity.
Yeah, because logistics and even picking your battles is a term that comes to mind for me, because there's quite a bit of client education that can be involved. And it's like, how much time do you want to spend trying to educate a potential client about the value of your photography when the photographer down the street is charging next to nothing for their images? And it's great that you have, it sounds like, a small loyal crowd that is willing to pay you what you're worth for the few assignments, commercial assignments that you decide to take on. And it's just, I think it's something. So covering your costs, back to logistics, you know, covering your costs, that's huge, right? And you were able to recognize that it wouldn't even have been worth it for you, that $2,500 wouldn't even cover a day and a half of what it would have cost you. And that's such an important point for those who are listening and just starting out, because I think a lot of people might jump at $2,500 and not even realize that they do have to cover expenses. If you have to hire a crew or assistance, and even your time, you have to know how much your time is worth.
Right. Well, you know, that when I first, shortly before I quit my old day job, I bought a book, and I forget what it was called. I should have looked this up, but it basically shows you how to calculate your day rate. And to just boil this down really quickly, you have to put everything, all of your expenditure for the year, so including your rent, your car, your insurance, your cameras. Maybe you're going to replace your camera body every 3 years. You need to put a third of that in. You may need to buy lenses. Everything that you need to pay out during that year, as thorough as possible, put it into a spreadsheet and get the total. And then on top of that, add how much you're going to need to save for the future, or, you know, anything else. And you basically come up with what you need to bring in per year, including taxes. You know, it's really easy to forget that you're going to have to pay, a lot of the time, you're going to have to pay a third or so of this back out as taxes. Mm-hmm. Put all of that in. And then you basically divide that yearly amount by roughly the number of days that you expect to work each year doing photography assignments. So I worked on 3.5 days because I know that for the other 3.5 days or 2.5 days or whatever, if probably working 6 days a week as a new business owner, I'm going to be working on the marketing and other various things to get myself back out into the field. And so I worked it out, I think, on 3.5 days. And it came to about $1,500, so $1,500 mm-hmm. per day. Mm-hmm. And that, it turns out, is pretty much an average day rate. But even if I don't work 3.5 days a week, I know that when I do work, if I don't charge that amount of money, I'm basically undercutting myself and I'm leaving myself short. So I have to be doing something that is leading towards me bringing in money. And the first year or so was actually quite tough because, you know, my wife was used to having a good salary coming in from my old job. And she saw me working literally 15, 16 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a lot of money coming in to begin with. And she would say, okay, so you're working like a dog. When is the money going to start coming in? Mm-hmm. And I just had to say to her, look, I'm planting seeds right now. All of these things that I'm doing are going to start, you know, one day we're going to wake up and there's going to be little shoots everywhere. And we'll you know, the flowers will start to grow and the world will be a wonderful place again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, surely enough, a year or so after I started planting all of these seeds, it did start to come around and things start. I mean, like, for example, my Japan tours, I had sold out my 2017 tours before we finished the 2016 tours.
Oh, that's great.
And so there's a lot of things that are going really, really well. And it's because of a number of things, partly because of the work that I did back then. But also, I feel that it's really important to provide as much value. We talked about this earlier, but provide as much value for people as possible. And people that come on my tours, they go away having had a great experience. You know, not everybody. I can't please 100% of my customers, but a lot of the time, the whole group goes away happy. And when that happens, they talk. And so the word of mouth helps me to fill future tours because, you know, like I say, I make people leave the tours with a good experience and lots of great photographs. And so this also comes back to something that I was going to touch on earlier, that I decided that I never wanted to do any job that I didn't want to do. Mm. And what I mean by that is that obviously if someone's going to pay me enough money to make me happy to do it, that's fine. But I don't want it. You know, people could pay me as much as they, as much money, you know, a truckload of cash. But if I don't actually want to go and do that work, I'm not going to do as good a job for that person as I would if they were asking me to photograph something that I really wanted to photograph. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, for example, people often ask me to do cherry blossom tours here in Japan or fall color. And I won't do them because I know that the crowds are huge here. When the cherry blossom comes out, I don't want to be leading 10, 12, 14 photographers around with me trying to photograph these things. I'd end up with a bus full of unhappy foreign visitors and I'd send them all at home unhappy. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to do that. So I pick my battles, but it really is all about doing work that I feel as though I really want to do. And then I'm able to just knock it out of the park in everything that I do.
Awesome. Awesome. Again, that theme of picking your battles, right?
Right.
And even recognizing that we do have a choice, which is empowering in and of itself.
Yeah. You know, I do understand that there are going to be people out there. You start photography, start doing this as a business, and you are going to have to do jobs that you don't want to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you're in that position, then you have to just knuckle down. And I think the biggest advice that I could give to someone that is in that position is learn to love what you're doing. And if you've got a camera in your hand, a lot of the time that's enough to make people happy doing what they do. Mm-hmm. But really try to work towards getting work that you really want to do. It's a means to an end rather than, you know, for example, I know wedding photographers And I mean that's an admirable genre of photography
It
for you right
is.
there. But they get burned out after a few years because as much as they love doing what they're doing, after a while, it just becomes so hard for them to put everything that they've got into photographing each wedding. The people that can really do that well year in, year out are, I think, a bit of a rarity. The majority of people I know that have made a good living at wedding photography generally move on to something that they really want to do later on in their careers.
Martin, how dare you describe me to the audience? Wow. That's a great point about burnout too. I mean, I years ago was doing weddings and it was giving me gray hairs. I mean, it was at the time it was the best money I had made and the best level of photography I was producing, but it was just sleepless nights and the amount of energy required and the planning. The first wedding I ever shot, I woke up with the flu that morning. That was awesome, an all day gig. I mean, I had an assistant, but still, it's a lot of work. And not to go off on too much of a tangent, but ironically, it seems that at least here in Michigan, when someone takes photos for fun and other family members and friends see that, that person seems to inevitably be asked at some point, "Hey, can you shoot my wedding?" And the person's like, "Sure, yeah, how hard could it be?" And then they're in for such an awakening as far as the level of work, and which is why I've stopped shooting weddings. And
I
I've
didn't
been,
realize that was where you came from. Sorry about
oh
that.
yeah, Michigan, yeah.
No, I mean you're
Oh,
as a wedding photographer. It's the
I've totally mentioned this on the show, and I wasn't doing solely weddings, so of course I had family portrait stuff in there too, and high school senior stuff, and a lot of people mix it in. And a lot of it you don't really realize it's not for you until you start doing it. And for me, it was weddings. And, I recently had a past client. We've worked together for years and she's getting married. And beautiful, beautiful girl and a beautiful wedding. It's going to be wonderful venue and location. And I had to turn it down, which was hard, very, very hard. But I just know that if I do that wedding, I'll get amazing photos, which is great, but then I'll get more people wanting me to do more weddings. It's like what you shoot, you tend to attract more of that. And I've had someone else say, "Well, why don't you just take it on? It'll be like a vacation. It's at a different destination. You can go and travel and have fun." And I told them, "It will not be a vacation. That is work. Lots and lots of work." So anyway, rant over, I'm done. But you make an excellent point. Some people thrive on it though. Some people thrive on that, and it's kudos to them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So then I'm curious then, what would you say is the most common mistake you see aspiring wildlife and nature photographers make when they want to begin monetizing their talent?
I think that wildlife and nature as a way of monetizing your photography activities is really, really hard. I think that people don't buy nature and wildlife photography as much as your general stock images with a bunch of happy people around a keyboard or everyone throwing popcorn in the air in a cinema. These sort of images sell better for a stock. I think that the if someone wanted to make a lot of money as a wildlife photographer, then you've really got to start at it as a passionate hobby and be prepared to stick to doing that for a while. And I think that a lot of the time it makes more sense to try and get another job that will help to pay for your excursions because unless you live in an area that has got wildlife in the backyard, then it's really difficult to do great wildlife work without traveling to some of the great wildlife areas. So, I mean, even if you want to be a full-time photographer, there are ways to support that sort of work with assignment work. But again, you've got to build that business. And I think that the biggest thing I get people ask me for advice all the time. People think that I've like an overnight success. And the truth is A, there's a lot of years of learning the craft and honing your skills before you get to a point where you can actually start to make money at doing this. It's definitely easier now. The instant feedback of digital is making the learning curve a lot shallower than it used to be. But my biggest advice often to these people is what they tend to do is they'll say, "Oh, I'm going to do a job next week, and you know, I'm just going to be great experience." And I'll say, "Well, how much are you going to charge them?" And I say, "Oh, well, I'm doing the first one for free." And I said, that is the biggest mistake, because people, here's what happens. People do, they say, "Oh, I'm going to work for free for a while because I, you know, I'm only just getting started. I need to build the experience." But what they're really doing is avoiding the money conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so easy for people to just sort of say, you know, make excuses as to why they're not going to talk about money. But really, it's not an excuse about anything to do with their skill level. They already know that they can do the photography. You need to use those first assignments both to build experience as a photographer, but also to build experience as a negotiator and a business person. You know, there's so much that you need to do. If you start working for free, it's going to be a lot more difficult to figure out how to talk about money later. So my advice for anyone just getting started is don't cut yourself, you know, don't, you know, undercut yourself. Try to learn about how to talk about money with a customer and how to, you know, actually negotiate your price. Work on your day rate. That's one of the best arming things that you can do. Know how much you need to charge that person before you walk into the room. And if budget and various aspects mean that they cannot give it you, then you need to get something of value for your time. Even say if you work for half your day rate, then you want something like, I don't know, model releases and the ability to sell the resulting photographs as stock images or something, access to a location that you wouldn't normally get access to, something that you feel valuable. But just walking in, doing a job for someone, getting paid peanuts or less than peanuts, and then walking away, spending another day or two processing the photographs and then handing them over for nothing, you're doing yourself and the photography business an unjust injustice.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a quick race to the bottom is what
Absolutely,
I like to say.
Yeah.
So Martin, is there a particular photography resource or tool, educational resource that you would recommend to our listeners who are trying to learn about and break into nature and wildlife photography?
Well, not just nature and wildlife, although that's a part of it, but I'd love to recommend Craft and Visions eBooks. And these are, I'm sure that most people that are interested in photography, even on a hobby sort of basis, are already going to know about Craft and Vision. But they've got a huge wealth of eBooks on just about every subject. Three of my eBooks are in there, so this is kind of a plug as well. But they don't charge a lot for them. They're between $5 and $8. Some of their bigger sort of 200-300 page books are $20. But they're very cheap for what they are. And it's an invaluable resource. So if people haven't already checked that out, I think that's definitely worth doing. It's at craftandvision.com.
Awesome. And my final question to you, but one of the most important, tell us where we can find you online.
Sure. So everything is linked at martinbaileyphotography.com. So it's Bailey. And Martin with an I, as in instead of a Y, that is. If you go to martinbaileyphotography.com, there's a toolbar at the top, and that's linked to my podcasts, to my tours, to my portfolios, if you want to check out my work, and also to my print sales and things like that.
Awesome. I highly encourage everybody to go check that out, because he's got some amazing stuff on his website, work and educational resources too. And the tours and workshops, looking at where you go, that looks amazing.
It's been a fun ride, and I'm hoping that the next 6 years and beyond are going to be as fun as the last have.
I don't doubt it.
Hope so.
Well, Martin, thank you so much for chatting with me. I appreciate you being willing to just talk to us and kind of give us an insight of how you run your business.
Not at all, Shamira. It's been a lot of fun.
If you're enjoying this podcast, I ask that you please leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you're listening. The more reviews we get, the easier it is for people to find this podcast and search rankings. We want to reach as many people as possible and help improve our photo industry. I appreciate you all. Thanks for listening.